thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, a biweekly discussion of how digital media and technology are affecting learning, teaching, and scholarship at colleges, universities, libraries, and museums.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 40 for the 27th of March 2009. Supermodels. I'm Dan Cohen. It's the 40th edition of the Digital Campus podcast. I'm Dan Cohen. Welcome back to the podcast. If you're an old-time listener, if you're a first-time listener, welcome to the podcast that discusses technology and what's going on in libraries, museums, and universities. Hopefully we didn't depress you too much from episode 39, where we discussed the way in which the downturn is impacting that, and we'll have a little follow-up on that in just a second. But I want to introduce the other co-hosts of the podcast, Tom Scheinfeld of foundhistory.org and at foundhistory on Twitter. Hey, Tom.
Hey, Dan.
Welcome back. Hope you're doing okay.
Thanks. Yeah.
And Tom is about to be a father for the first time. Very exciting.
Yes. So, right. If I drop off the podcast suddenly, you'll know why. It's imminent. So.
Right. If there's a little Tom Scheinfeld hiatus from Digital Campus, we are expecting you to live blog or Twitter.
I'm going to try to avoid being that guy.
You sure? We can
Good. Get
you, maybe a flip video cam you could take in there.
Do you think your wife would mind that? I think my wife would have a bit.
You've got a blog, you've got podcasts, you're on Twitter. Come on,
I have all these channels to.
Yes, the whole world wants to see the photographs of the birth as it happens
live. Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe I'll come for that, and I'll do it since you'll be busy.
All right. Well, then I can
helping her breathe and do all that stuff. The other voice you hear, of course, is Mills Kelly of EdWired.org and the fake at Ed Wired on Twitter. He's actually not on Twitter, as old-time listeners know, the Twitter skeptic, Mills Kelly. Hey, Mills.
Hey, it's me. I'm here.
Welcome back to the podcast. And also Gorby Fest this week at Mason, Mikhail Gorbachev was here, and Mills was running the show. How'd that go?
You know, it went incredibly well, and it's also led to a new excuse for why I'm behind in my email, which is Gorbachev ate my homework.
It seems like a pretty good excuse to me. We were discussing before the podcast. So Gorby is on Facebook, but not on Twitter. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, he has a pretty active Facebook community, but not on Twitter. So at least he and I agree about something.
I'm surprised there's not a fake Gorby. We should.
Well, there's somebody a Gorby? If you search for Mikhail Gorbachev on Twitter, you get some post there's only one post on there, and it's a threatening thing from Linden Labs saying, whatever you're doing, cease and desist. Like, why Linden Labs has something to do with that, I don't know.
Huh, very odd. Well, he should go grab a username and join Shaquille O'Neal and the others on there. I think he'd be a great celeb to be on
Gorby.
There. Yeah. Okay. Well. Tom Mills, did you? Since our depressing episode 39, where we talked about the Great Recession and its impact, any other news stories that came up that kind of touched on that issue before we dive into the new and hopefully happier news from the past 2 weeks?
Sadly, yes. I noticed a couple of things. Two of them here in our home state of Virginia. It seems as though the University of Virginia, on the one hand, is going to be phasing out its computer labs. Over the next 3 years, they're going to be getting rid of all of their computer labs. They did a survey and they found that almost all of their students, 99% of their students, arrive on campus with laptops. And they figured, why do we need to maintain these expensive labs in the downturn? This was a good, I think, reason for them to phase those out. I think that the other thing the story mentioned, this is a story in the Chronicle of Higher Ed, mentioned that most of the students, 95% of the use of those lab computers was for text documents and web browsing, which they figure people can do on their own machines. They don't need, you know, a new you know, less than 2 year old nice high powered machine to be doing those kinds of things. So they're phasing out the labs, and then Virginia Tech, the Virginia Tech Library, is cutting its journal subscription budget by $1 million for the next year. So they are reacting to the what we've talked about often here, the high price of especially scientific journals. So,
right. You know,
more downturn news.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'll have to pull up this article and link to it from digitalcampus.tv, but I did see that Reed Elsevier, which publishes a lot of those expensive science journals, they actually had an increase in revenue and profits last year in 2008. I mean, right. What other businesses are that recession proof?
Walmart.
Right. Walmart. Right.
Yeah. Funeral homes.
Right. Right. Right.
And science journals. Gosh.
And interestingly, I learned on Tuesday night, independent movie theaters. One of the people I met through this Gorbachev event was a guy who owns a chain of independent movie theaters in the Midwest, you know, sort of like arts cinemas. And he said that 2008 was one of their best years ever. Hmm. And he said he thinks it's that people, you know, that movies are still relatively inexpensive, and he's not showing, you know, blockbuster films, so I suspect he might be charging a little less. But movies are, you know, maybe a little cheaper than a lot of other kinds of entertainment, and like going out for dinner, for instance. And so he said they did really well this past year, and then the first part of this year they're doing well too.
Wow.
Who knew? Yeah, so, who knew?
Right. So Reed Elsevier, earnings per share were up 24%. In their earnings call from March 20th, 2009.
Well, maybe that was the straw that broke Virginia Tech's back. I think, you know, it's going to be hard for them to justify in the midst of, you know, huge budget cuts, especially in the state universities. It's going to be hard for them to justify those kinds of profits.
Right, right. You know, one thing we didn't really touch on last week is, or maybe we did. I should go back and listen. But, you know, that feeling of everyone kind of having to work together, or everyone having to sacrifice. And I think groups, you know, I probably should have read this Reed Elsevier article a little bit more closely and seen what the breakdown is in terms of their journals and versus their other information profits. But, you know, I think universities right now are really feeling like, well, if you're not kind of sharing in our pain, then we don't like you. I mean, I would assume this is true in museums and libraries as well. So, you know, software companies that want to raise their rates or journal subscriptions that want to just keep going up at 10% a year, surely this year in 2009, they're going to be looked at even more harshly than they were in the past.
Yeah, the thing that worries me about this journal subscription thing is what's going to happen to the kind of marginal journals, you know, the not American Historical Review journals, the, you know, the ones I know, Central European History, Nationalities papers, journals that are not well supported, and you know, what's going to happen to them? And you know, the quick answer is, oh, well, they'll just become web journals. Well, of course, as though that were free. So, you know, what really worries me is that a lot of these smaller journals that do really important work in sort of, you know, corners of the humanities and social sciences as opposed to the mainstream, a lot of them are just going to get squeezed out of existence and with nobody to fund them. And I worry that universities won't make that leap of saying, okay, well, right now we're giving you a graduate assistant and you know, and a part-time secretary because you're the editor of this journal and because it's a real paper journal, but if it goes over to a web journal, I worry that universities are going to not support it in the same way, and that a lot of these journals will just evaporate.
Well, they're certainly going to – I mean, these smaller journals, they're going to have to operate on very lean budgets. You know, I assume for a while there will still be paper subscriptions, but you know, going to web, right? There are still editorial costs and things like that. But, you know, I mean, this is going to have to be a time to be creative on those fronts, isn't it? I mean, it's probably going to have to involve a little bit more crowdsourcing, a little bit less fussiness in terms of things like, you know, that kind of final 5% of editing that really costs a lot, you know, to get all the footnotes correct, things like that.
But the most important service that these journals provide is already free, and that's the peer review.
Peer review costs
these journals nothing. We all read manuscripts. We all read early submissions, and we all do that for free. So it seems to me that the most vital function that these journals perform is already being done on the cheap, and that can continue. It's just a matter of the distribution model and things like the finishing touches, the editing, the typography, those things you were mentioning, Dan. So I'm not hugely optimistic, but I think there's that if we can focus on that most important function that these journals provide, and enable them to continue to do that well, these other pieces about distribution and access and things can fall into place.
Right. I mean, for those of us who are, you know, have blogs and things like that, it just seems at this point in 2009, the whole idea of marketing or, you know, getting the attention doesn't seem like a big problem at this point. And there are mechanisms that are arising that are effectively crowdsourced by people linking and retweeting and all these other things for finding interesting, good stuff, no matter where it's published and through whatever process. So, I mean, it seems like on some of these smaller journals, they could use something like the Open Journal System from UBC, of course, pkp.ubc.ca. Is that the address? Anyway, we'll link to it. But there are, you know, free kind of web, if you want a good web-based journal, there are ways to go with that, or in the
review.org,
REVUES.org runs about 2,000 journals that are freely available online. They have systems for editing, et cetera. And Tom, like you said, they deal with all the issues of, you know, sending the paper out for review, making it look nice, formatting it, all that stuff is really taken care of. So it's, again, if you can set up something that's pretty lean, you can have an online journal pretty inexpensively.
Well, and you could also imagine that some of these smaller journals especially could just forgo the publication function altogether and become more like peer review services. We saw another story this week, huge story, that MIT has adopted an open access mandate for all of its faculty publications. And so you could imagine that some of this could just be done through these open access mandates on the university campuses, where the universities provide a space for faculty members to mount their articles or publicate those things formerly known as publications, and they're really just sending them to what were journals for peer review. The journal accepts it, sends it back to the to the faculty member, and then the faculty member puts it up on the university's website or on his own website, and it's just stamped with approval from the former journal, now peer review service. I can imagine a model like that. So I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of change here, and I think we're gonna see some new models emerging. That's going to be a combination of a lot of these different movements in this area.
Right. I mean, it seems to me like you said, Tom, that I mean, clearly the hosting, all that stuff is taken care of now. I mean, MIT, and this is obviously a huge story from the last couple of weeks, going open access. And also, really, if you read the kind of press release on it and also some of the faculty comments at MIT, really kind of sticking it to this effort in Congress right now to try to essentially repeal the open access provision that was put in place, only a year and a half ago, for federally funded scientific articles at NIH, for instance. Is it the Dingell provision that's in that House Act that's trying to kind of repeal that? You know, so, gosh, if MIT's there, if Harvard's there, I mean, I think this really makes people stand up and notice that you can, you know, go ahead and post to. I mean, MIT is the home of DSpace and So you can just, you know, if you're a faculty member, put your article there. And then really the journals are more about, like you said, Tom, peer review, and also saying, look, this is really excellent. This is something you should look at rather than as a means of distribution.
The other thing I think that's really interesting, and what Tom just raised about journals not really being journals anymore, but being peer review services, is that the question of whether the peer review takes place before or after the thing goes up online, I'd actually be an advocate of putting things up online and then having some sort of peer review service look at them and then put the seal of approval on them, because then that doesn't constrict the speed with which things appear online.
Right.
And,
right.
And you know, you think you have something that's now worthy of the level of peer review that would call it a publication in the old sense, then you know, something that would count, then I think you submit that to some sort of peer review service and say, you know, I'd like a seal of approval on that, where this other thing is just a blog post or a tweet or something like that.
Right, but this starts to start looking like scholarly blogging almost, where you, you know, have a blog and some of the things you write are, you know, rise to a level of scholarship, and some of the things you write are just, you know, links or things you notice from around the web,
right,
or whatever.
Right.
And you know, you might submit some of those to a service. I think that's a great idea. I think there's all kinds of models out there that we're gonna be seeing emerging in the next, and I hope. And I think, you know, this downturn is an opportunity for some of these new models to really take hold.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think one of the things that might happen is, you know, I think a lot of us read Clay Shirky's piece on, you know, the future of newspapers, and, you know, in which he basically said, you know, newspapers don't really have a right to exist. Their model might be gone. It might be that their model cannot be reinvented. And I think one of the things that has to go on right now in our world is to think about, you know, is the journal something that absolutely needs to exist and needs a reinvention, or is it something that can be taken care of through new means that aren't 100% clear right now? And, you know, when I think about the online world we participate in, by blogging and by being on Twitter, except for you, Mills, we know. But you can really say, for instance, at the end of the month, what the important pieces of writing were for that last month. Wouldn't you say so, Mills and Tom? I mean, we kind of ferreted out without any kind of master editor to tell us that, because people are commenting about things that are interesting, people link to things, and, you know, that's what I'm just saying, is I think we might have to be maximally flexible about what we consider the peer review system, and it might not be something where you say there is a March 2009 edition of this particular topic.
Right. Well, and I think the Clay Shirky piece definitely is something everybody should read if they haven't already. I mean, one of the things he said was that, you know, the old models will break before the new models are invented, and there's going to be this period where that there aren't good models for some of these, to perform some of the functions that journalism performed, or that journals performed. I think absolutely. I mean, I know that, like, in our little community of digital humanists, I mean, one of the really important things that happened during February was Mike Edson's movie that he presented at WebWise, which showed the angry curator and the arrogant, slick web 2.0 webmaster. And, you know, that was a non-traditional publication, but it had a lot of resonance in the museum community, and it made a big splash, and it crystallized a lot of the ideas that people had been talking around for months and even years. And so, you know, I think you're right. I think some of this stuff rises to the top with all these social networking technologies. That may be a little too informal for a lot of scholars.
Yeah, right.
It may have to work in tandem with some more formalized, more rigorous peer review systems, but I think there's a new model out there that's going to incorporate all these new technologies.
Well, and the thing, you know, I'm struck by this conversation because a couple of weeks ago I was up at Penn doing a workshop with some grad students, and a couple of faculty members were there as well. And one of them, who's very sympathetic to digital humanities, has done a couple of websites, sort of small things himself. He said, okay, this is all great, but how does the uneducated digital humanist, the person, or the uneducated person interested in the humanities, know where to start?
Right.
And because right now, you know, if you, you know, okay, you're an undergraduate student and you're taking a historical methods course, your professor probably explains to you something about the hierarchy of academic journals and that, and you know, what peer review means and what it doesn't mean. And so you have some sense that, okay, these journals are probably better than these, and something that's just, you know, thrown together and published as a working paper is not the same thing as a journal article. And so you have some sense of the hierarchy of quality to start with, where, you know, on the web, who knows? And so so his concern, and I think it's a really valid concern, is at this period of transition that we're in, how does the person who doesn't spend all this time thinking about it the way that we do, how do they know where to start? And I think we're 10 years away from clarity on that.
It could be that the journal is, you know, the start page for research in a particular topic, in the same way that you get, you know, if you look at the web designs of, let's say, you know, Chronicle of Higher Ed online at chronicle.com or New York Times, there's kind of bigger headlines and smaller headlines relating to, you know, big research pieces, investigative journalism, lead stories, and then kind of smaller things that now, for instance, the New York Times puts in the right-hand columns that are in smaller font and have to do with blogs, more informal communications that come through NewYorkTimes.com. But that's just it. I mean, we don't really know, do we? You know, these are interesting times, especially with this huge inflection point of use of things like Facebook or Twitter, particularly in the kind of over 30 set that's now happened over the last, let's say, 6 months, where you see this huge growth curve. I think more people will be experiencing that feeling of, oh, I'm getting a link to that, I'm seeing what these other people are talking about, and maybe that will become a little clearer to others what they might be able to kind of glean more informally without needing, you know, sort of relying on some master editor to show them this is important, this isn't.
Yeah, and so imagine for just a second that whoever the next executive director of the American Historical Association turns out to be when Arnita retires, says the American Historical Association in 1 year is going to cease the publication of the American Historical Review after a century or however long it's been, because academic journals are over and we just don't realize that yet. And so instead, we're going to take all of those resources that we've devoted to the publication of this wonderful journal, and we're going to put them into becoming an approval service for web-based content. You know, an editorial board saying, here's a seal of approval on this, here's a seal of approval on that. And we're going to spend the same amount of money, but we're going to do it to start focusing on the digital world that's emerging instead of the print world that's fading. That would be a moment to live for.
Yeah, well, you know, unfortunately...
And I'm not saying that Arnita is, you know, opposing this or anything. I'm just saying, just imagine that whoever the next person is says something like that. That's when we'll know that the old model really is going to expire and then some new model is going to emerge.
Right.
Well, we may actually be sort of seeing this in the book publishing world, that there's I think probably the biggest story of the last couple of weeks is the University of Michigan story, where they're going to a more or less all digital publication model. And there, I think, you know, they are sort of thinking, it seems like, that they could serve as this kind of approval service for digital production. We should probably talk about the story more, but it is this more forward looking notion of what a publisher really really does.
Right, and I think the point there is, we should probably mention this, but University of Michigan Press, I mean, did do a release. It looks like they're being effectively folded into the library, put on the library budget, and kind of released from the need to kind of support themselves through earnings on the books, which of course skews the kinds of publications they want to do, and thus gives them a kind of structure to support more monographs. But of course, in doing that, they're also trying to reduce the costs on those monographs. So it looks like they're going to start using a kind of fuller digital platform that includes print on demand, so they're not, you know, printing out 500 copies of expensive hardbacks, cloth produce that, you know, only sells 250 copies. So, you know, just exploring this new model. You know, and I think kudos to them. You know, what I would say is to the head of a press or the head of a journal is, okay, maybe things are unclear in the next 3 to 5 years, but Do you really think there's going to be an American Historical Review in print in 50 years in paper?
I don't think there's going to be in 10 years.
Yeah. So, right. So you do that thought exercise and then you say, well, you could wait until you're the equivalent of the mimeograph sheet that's, you know, sent by mail, or you could start doing something now.
Right, you could start experimenting. I don't think there's a good model, but at least some of these organizations are understanding that they need to at least experiment. Because
right.
That's the only thing that's going to keep them ahead of the curve.
Right. I mean, of course, the scary part of this is you know, we should say that there's a human cost to this experimentation, that you know, that this might involve cutting staff at a press or at a journal. You know, there is an impact to this.
And we've seen a lot of that in the last couple of weeks. University of Missouri Press and some others have laid off a lot of staff.
I think it's important, though, to also remember that there's sort of two things going on simultaneously that have affected these presses. And one of them is that, you know, there's something really important is changing in academic publishing. And the other is we're in the middle of an economic crisis. And so, you know, those people who worked for the press, those skills that they have as editors or typographers or whatever, many of those skills are transferable to the new models, whatever they turn out to be. A lot of the jobs that are being lost because universities are broke at the moment. The other thing I would say about this is that I guess maybe 3 or 4 years ago at an American Historical Association conference, there was a pre-conference workshop on like the future of digital humanities or something like that. And one of the afternoon sessions was just people from the university presses. And I've rarely been in a room where there was that much fear. And this was 3 or 4 years ago, because they already knew 3 or 4 years ago that they were doomed in the current model that they were in. And as one speaker said, the principal problem that they have is that there's no cost recovery model for their business. So with the exception of the 10 or 12 top-end university presses that actually function as publishers in the same way that McGraw-Hill does or something like that, that are profitable, the rest of the university press world is not profitable, and universities increasingly are focusing on cost and cost recovery. And so even several years ago, they knew they were in serious trouble. So I think it's just, I think the university press as we've known it for the last 50 years or so is really doomed.
I thought we were going to do a more uplifting podcast.
Oh, sorry. But actually, that could
we're
be a
trying,
good thing.
Folks.
You know?
We're
that
trying, folks. We're
trying.
Yeah, no. It's true. I mean, and if you had looked under the hood at these university presses, you talk to the editors in chief, you talk to the managers. Even 10 years ago, they were really supported by, you know, a very select number of publications that often weren't, you know, the real core mission books that they want to publish, you know, the leading edges of scholarship that would only sell 500 copies, that were very important in terms of changing a field. You know, a lot of these university presses had, you know, that hidden one or two or three books that sold thousands of copies every year. And it was things like, you know, medical handbooks that families buy, or travel books to Europe that had nice pictures and that sold a lot of copies. And they were things that you could imagine at a commercial press, but they were really things that kind of kept these presses alive. And no press, I mean, you're right, the economics have gone away. I mean, you just can't, if you imagine a press that was just all monographs selling 200 hardback copies, I don't really see the business model. The business model's really never been there for that, or hasn't been there for that for the last 10 years. So, you know, with that sense of doom, as Tom said, I suppose has to come experimentation on it.
And I would refer all of our listeners to a very interesting speech that was given at the University of Virginia on, of all dates, February the 4th, 1999, so 10 years ago, by Stan Katz up at Princeton, and he just recently retired from the ACLS at this point, has a wonderful title, "A Computer is Not a Typewriter, or Getting Right with Information Technology in the Humanities." 10 years ago, Stan was already talking about all of this, and so it's really interesting to see the sort of how the things he talked about back in 1999 have really come to fruition, and how the three of us are still rehashing some of his ideas from back then.
Yeah, undoubtedly. But maybe we should get Stan on the podcast here.
I think so.
Great idea.
We'll have to link to that. If you could pull up that article, yep. Mills, that would be great to link to from digitalcampus.tv. Well, you know, same theme here. Speaking of experimentation, you know, another story, this Sony adding 500,000 public domain books from the Google Book Search scanning project to their reader. You know, some of the things that have gone on that front, you know, the iPhone 3.0 release that we saw over the last week also has a kind of interesting possibility for publishers to, for instance, sell a book or an article within an iPhone app. It seems like these new platforms continue to evolve, continue to present ways in which these more traditional forms of a kind of long form narratives can be put out, sold, repackaged, etc.
Right, and I think the University of Michigan is trying to jump on board some of these things. I think I could imagine a university. I could almost imagine the University of Michigan Press becoming an iPhone app, which has many, many more titles than they're able to do now. And they have all received the stamp of approval of the University of Michigan, and they're distributed in that way. You could imagine a university press becoming something more like that iPhone app. This is a move, I think, too, by Sony to counter some of the press and the success that Kindle and Amazon have had, and you know, I think teaming up with Google is probably a smart move for Sony, and I think that's just a good. I think it will be good to have at least two players in this ebook reader game. I would hate to see ebook readers, the Kindle, become what the iPod is now for music players, basically right. The only one.
Right. I mean, couldn't you get a consortium of university presses that, you know, had, let's say, an application or a kind of, you know, bookstore on Amazon or on the iPhone? And let's say you could explore a subscription model. You can get every single monograph that comes out from Harvard University Press for $49.95 a year. You know, that's pretty attractive to me. If I went on vacation, I wanted to browse around through a bunch of their books. You know, I probably don't buy more than a couple of their books a year at $25 or $30 a piece.
Right.
So,
and then if you could have some kind of print on demand model where the ones that you know, you browse a few, and then the ones that you really want to read, you get some kind of a discount. You get a $15.99, you can get the book, or $9.99, you can get the print on demand copy to actually, you know, bring to the beach with you. That seems like a very promising model, much more promising than actually firing up an actual printing press to print 200 copies of a book and then putting those books on trucks to libraries all over the world.
And right. and you know, imagine also then going to sort of the full iPhone app route, where instead of the app store, you have the bookstore. And so I'm an author, and I write a book, and rather than going through all the trouble of dealing with an agent and a press and all, you know, an Amazon and all that kind of stuff, I just decide I'm going to put up the first chapter on the Apple bookstore, which you can download the first chapter for, you know, $9.99, and if you want the whole book, then that costs another $1.99, and so, you know, the store just becomes the direct conduit between the author and the reader. And then if you want the print on demand, you know, you can get that for some greater amount, as Tom was saying. And I can imagine an awful lot of writers who will do that.
Yeah. Well, many, many models. I'm sure we'll continue to follow this as the year goes on and revisit that issue. Time for picks of the week, or of the 2 weeks, I suppose, since we're bi-weekly, or at least try to be. Mills, what do you have for us this week that you found online, or a piece of software, or something online, that offline, that we should read?
Well, at the beginning of the podcast, you mentioned that I was recovering from the Gorbachev conference we had here at George Mason. And one of the great things about the conference was, after Gorbachev spoke in our Center for the Arts, then we had all sorts of student questions coming up to the podium for him to respond to. And the first question was something along the lines of, President Gorbachev, you withdrew your country's forces from Afghanistan. What advice would you give to President Obama about how the United States could extract itself from Afghanistan? And so that reminded me that the National Security archive at George Washington University has just recently put up a really nice collection of translated Soviet documents from the 1985 decision to withdraw, the Gorbachev's decision to withdraw Soviet forces from Afghanistan. And so sort of a 20-year retrospective on that decision. And it's a really nice, concise collection of documents for anyone who wants to see sort of a nice parallel between what happened to the Soviet Union 20 years ago and what the United States may find itself in now. And it's just another example of how the people at the National Security Archive are doing all kinds of great work.
Huh. That sounds really interesting. Great. Thanks very much. Okay. Tom, what do you have for us this week?
Well, I've got less of a – well, I guess it's a pick, but it's more of a reminder. The deadline for applications for that camp, the Humanities and Technology Camp that we've talked about on the podcast, and that's being held here again at George Mason at the Center for History and New Media on June 27th and 28th, I believe, right time to coincide with or to follow the Digital Humanities 09 conference at University of Maryland, being hosted by our friends at MITH. Applications are due on April 1st, so I encourage everybody who's listening to put in an application. If they can join us here in Fairfax, that camp is a fantastic event. And I guess I also want to plug the blogs of the two geniuses behind that camp, our own Dave Lester at davelester.org and Jeremy Boggs at cleoweb.org.
Yeah, a lot of fun, a lot of fun. I'll be there. Hope to see you there. Mills, are you going to be able to make it to that camp?
Oh, yeah, I'll be there.
Great. Yeah, I mean, we just learned so much last year, and it's just fun. It's just a good – I just like the overall attitude to that camp and just the idea of an unconference. Just a lot more enjoyable and also productive than your normal academic conference.
Yep, thatcamp.org.
Thatcamp.org, great. And you'll, when this comes out, you'll only have a couple of days to do it. So if you're listening to this, do it now, backcamp.org. Well, I have just a quick pick. I was interviewed over the last week by Jeff Young, who's a technology reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Ed, who's writing an article about academics who Twitter and just, you know, he was really feeling that we have hit this inflection point where a lot of people are jumping on Twitter, except for someone. Who could that be? So I was just thinking a really good way for people new to Twitter. Part of the problem with Twitter is that you just don't know, as you do on Facebook, kind of how to find people and who to follow and who to listen in on. So oftentimes new users, I think, will probably have a lot of trouble kind of finding people in their area, whether it's libraries or museums or a particular academic discipline. I actually think that this... WeFollow.com is emerging as a great place to go to find people. And the way you can do it is using tags. So if you go to WeFollow.com and then type in, for instance, your discipline, let's say it's literature or art, into the tag section search box, you'll get a pretty good list. It's a little tricky. You need to play around with it a little bit. For instance, if you're interested in art and you type in artist, you'll get, for instance, some... music recording artists, so Kylie Minogue, for instance, rather than a painter that you want to follow. So you have to play around a little bit, but it is quickly emerging. You know, if you go to history, you get a lot of historians, you know, you go to philosophy, you'll get philosophers, and you can kind of pick and choose, take a look, sample it first before following someone, but it might be an easy way to kind of quickly pick up 10 or 12 or 15 people that you might want to just get a feel for Twitter if you are new to it. The problem with Twitter, of course, is that the people they recommend when you first log on are people like Britney Spears or CNN and or Shaquille O'Neal. And I assume, although I'm not sure how our audience feels, but I'm assuming that they might not want to necessarily follow those people. So this is a great way for you to find people maybe in the longer tail of scholarship and people in the cultural heritage world to take a sampling on Twitter at wefollow.com. Well, thanks, Mills and Tom, and thanks to our audience for joining in. And we'll be back in another 2 weeks for another episode of Digital Campus.
we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.